And now on to introductions. I am absolutely delighted to have with us today Dr. Tom DeLowry, who is Professor of Medicine, Pathology, and Pediatrics in the Division of Hematology Oncology and Laboratory Medicine at OHSU. Dr. DeLowry, some of you may know, is a Hoosier who graduated from Indiana State University just a year after Larry Bird and also received his medical degree at Indiana University School of Medicine. He did his internship at University of California, Irvine, before coming to Portland to finish his residency and also complete fellowship in oncology and hematology at OHSU. His clinical interests are in iron deficiency, general hematology and coagulation, subjects on which many of us know he has written and taught extensively. He was course director for the medical school blood course for 10 years and has been awarded numerous teaching awards. Dr. Lowry also has a strong interest in the hematologic aspects of wilderness medicine and served 6 years on the board of directors of the Wilderness Medicine Society and chairs their research committee. He has multiple wilderness medicine publications and is a board member of Pacific Northwest Wilderness Medicine. Dr. Lowry is so skilled and generous with his teaching. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. Great. It's hard to getting used to live talking again. I realized halfway here, I gotta be wearing pants. Anyway, so thank you very much for coming to my talk. My only not really relevant disclosure is I'm an editor up to date on iron, the best part of up to date. And another disclosure is if this was an honest talk about what is the greatest animal hazards, they're actually statistically, most people die either of farm injuries with cattle or getting hit in a car by a deer, but that's not very exotic or what people think of wilderness medicine. So instead, I'm going to focus on animals in the Northwest we really need to respect. Bees and wasps, snakes, and then focus on big animals, or as I like to call them, charismatic megafauna. So about three people remember the killer bees from Saturday Night Live, probably about as many people now who remember who Larry Bird was. But bees and wasps are actually pretty deadly animals. We think usually with stings, the local reactions, it does take a lot of bee stings to kill somebody. The lethal dose is estimated to be 20 stings per kilogram, where you get shock, DIC, multi-organ system failure. But the true hazards of stings is anaphylaxis. And this is estimated to kill at least 60 people a year, more than bears and rattlesnakes and anything else. And this may be underestimated, as some people may be stung and die, and they're just considered a sudden death. Now, wasps really are nasty stings, and that's because their venom is very rich in histamine, bradykinins, phospholipase. There can be many marked pain and local reactions. About 10% of people with wasp stings get those big local reactions bigger than 10 centimeters. I was running in a road race once and a wasp got in between my headband and my forehead. I got stung multiple times, which led to many interesting patient conversations. But again, here's a wasp, and notice the stinger is sharp. It's not barbed. So a wasp can sting multiple times. Bees actually don't die after the sting. Bees can live 1 to 5 days after stinging you. So they do lose their stinging apparatus, but actually still go on and do productive things in the hive. What's important to remember when you're stung by a bee is 90% of the venom is delivered very rapidly within the first 10 or so seconds. It's about 150 micrograms of venom. Again, the LD50 from the venom alone is very high. A protein called melitin is the main component of the venom. It actually acts on pain fibers, so it's why bee stings are so painful. There's also some lytic proteins, phospholipase, but the main thing of a bee sting is it hurts. Again, here's an Alaska bumblebee. And again, the stinging apparatus is very elaborate. It's designed to inject rapidly a lot of venom. The stinger is barbed, so it stays in you. Now, what do you do when you're stung by a bee? get the stinger out of there as fast as possible. You know, people used to have this concern like, don't pinch it, you'll inject more venom, just scrape it off. But actually, you need just to get it off of you as fast as possible. Because if you go and, you know, spend 30 seconds finding your credit card, the venom's already been injected. And believe it or not, there's actually been clinical trials of this. Probably got some medical students to volunteer. But again, the time to removal, even with 8 seconds, the wound gets larger. And again, just simply pinching or getting the stinger off of you as fast as possible actually delivers less venom. So if you're stung, get the darn thing off of you. Now, probably up to 8% of people are allergic to bee stings. Sadly, 40% of people get anaphylaxis, never knew they had an allergy. In kids, urticaria, angioedema is most common. In adults, again, the classic signs of anaphylaxis, pharyngeal edema, bronchospasm, shock. The clinical history is the key. If they present the emergency department, high tryptase is very helpful. The issue obviously is there is a risk of anaphylaxis with future stings. Can be up to 30 to 60%. This can be reduced with venom immunotherapy, but anybody who's had any severe reaction to a sting should carry epinephrine and should carry it on their person. I've heard of people getting stung and like, oh, the epinephrine's in my kit, in my car, which doesn't help you if you're on a side of a mountain. So we need to emphasize to our allergic patients, they literally need to carry it with them on their body everywhere. Well, snake bites are a huge issue worldwide. There's actually an estimated 140,000 deaths. The United States is about 6,000 to 7,000 snake bites a year, but only about 2.5 deaths per year. If you're really interested or get bored during the talk, all the U.S. deaths are listed on Wikipedia. And so again, most of the deaths occur in countries with not great access to healthcare. People working in the fields, they get stung by a cobra, and they really can't access healthcare. It's also a function that a lot of the world's most poisonous snakes, like what we call the elapids that deliver neurotoxins, live in these areas. And again, here is Wikipedia and the snake bites, mainly rattlesnakes. So the U.S. has 4 venomous snakes. The only one we really need to worry about in the Northwest are rattlesnakes. Copperheads are in the Midwest, water moccasins south and Midwest, coral snakes the Southwest. Rattlesnakes are pretty obvious. They have a rattle. And there's kind of been a revolution in nomenclature. We used to think there was 4 species, multiple subspecies. Now everybody's just decided there's over 40 species. Western rattlesnakes, probably the main one we see in the Northwest. So again, here's the range of the Western rattlesnake. And then the timber rattlesnake also has a presence in Oregon. And again, it's also called the Great Basin. And then example of the Pacific. And again, notable things are obviously the rattle. These are pit vipers. They tend to have a triangular head and very muscular bodies. Now, if we had a national snake, it probably would be the rattlesnake. The rattlesnake is almost everywhere, except a little bit, not that much actually, in Wisconsin or Minnesota. Kind of interesting. They have Lyme disease and all sorts of things, but not rattlesnakes. Not too sure which one I would choose. Pit vipers have venom. And what's really interesting is about the venom of pit vipers is it's not steady. They actually adjust it during different seasons, different areas. It's an active area of research that actually somehow vipers can control the composition of their venom. And we'll talk about the multiple toxicity. They have retractable fangs in order to sting you better. And the pit comes from the fact that on their face, they have a heat sensing pit so they can track and identify prey. So again, here is the pit viper. There's the venom gland, the heat sensing pit. Again, the huge fangs are like hypodermic needles hollowed out to effectively deliver venom. They actually have a glottis that can extend. So while they're wolfing down their meal, they can breathe. Again, these are very elaborate animals, very well designed to deliver venom. So there's all sorts of things about how to tell a poisonous from non-poisonous snakes, like their anal plate. I'm really gonna pick up a snake and look at its butt to figure out if it's poisonous or not, but apparently you can do that. They have elliptical pupils, triangular heads, but again, we're fortunate. You know, the venomous snake in the Northwest has a rattle, so that's a pretty good clue. Now, again, the venom is a bewildering array of toxins. There's probably over 15 proteins. A lot of it's local tissue damage, lysis of the animals, because again, most of the time the venom is to get and help digest prey. It can cause a coagulopathy. Neuropathy is pretty rare with most rattlesnakes, except the Mohave rattlesnake. So a lot of it is local tissue damage. There's phospholipases that dissolve cell membranes. There's metalloproteases that dissolve proteins. There's hyaluronases that dissolve connective tissue. So the damage is mainly local with rattlesnake bites. There's skin necrosis. There's muscle necrosis. It disrupts vascular integrity. So here's an unfortunate gentleman bit by a rattlesnake. There's very oppressive edema. You can see vessel breakdown, hemorrhage occurring in this, and underneath it, there's some muscle necrosis. Here's another example of extensive ecchymoses, very intense swelling. And as CNN helplessly reminds us, this is one reason not to pose with a selfie with a rattlesnake. So there is an intense coagulopathy. Actually, a lot of snake venom proteins have been isolated and we use it as diagnostic tests like the Russell Viper venom time. But these can lead to, you know, coagulopathies, bleeding. It can interfere with platelet function. Integrilin actually comes from snake venom or is derived from a snake venom protein. And this can persist for weeks. This is a platelet count after a snake bites. They go down, you get the antivenom wears off, and the thrombocytopenia recurs. So what happens if somebody gets bit by a viper? The first signs are very local, and it usually happens within an hour. There's extreme pain, there's swelling, there's erythema, there's bleeding, and a lot of blistering. And this will gradually continue to progress. If it progresses, it develops necrosis. These are worrisome signs. Now, what's interesting and not well understood is that about 25% of viper bites are actually dry bites. You get stung, but there's no venom. It's probably just like a warning signal or, you know, the viper didn't want to waste it on you or anything. So if somebody gets bit and nothing's happened in 8 hours, then it's probably a dry bite. But again, here's a picture of a small bite, but again, pretty nasty necrosis. Here's another picture demonstrating the marked erythema, and this is pretty typical. Erythema, swelling can be seen. It can be pretty intense. Compartment syndrome is actually very rare. It's mainly just on the tissue, on the superficial tissue and not the deep tissue. So there can be systemic issues, there can be shock, there can be very diffuse bleeding, especially at the site of any trauma. Occasionally there's enough of a dose delivered to get dysrhythmias and other heart rhythm issues. So immediate treatment is don't mess around. All those things about cutting the bite, sucking the venom, using cryotherapy, you know, putting battery cables on it, it's in the literature, doesn't work. Just get the person as quickly to the hospital. If I'm out running and I get bit by a snake, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to run my car and drive myself to St. Vincent's because it's the closest hospital. So just get the person to the hospital. Local therapy does more harm than good. Again, physical exam the wound area. Coagulation labs are very important. Edema can be very marked. It can be confused for compartment syndrome. But actually, compartment syndrome is very rare with snake bites. This is an unfortunate gentleman who decided to kiss his pet rattlesnake. Yes, alcohol was involved. We can see here the very intense swelling. There's a lot of bleeding. This person actually needed a cricothyrotomy, a cric, to preserve his airway. Again, local tissue bleeding can really complicate care. therapy, and I'm not going to go over this, this is in the wilderness medicine guidelines, but really is anti-venom. And interestingly, anti-venom is not dosed per weight, it's dosed per severity of bites. And again, most emergency room has this, most poison control centers will guide you how to use it. There's two main types of anti-venom on the market. The oldest is Crofab, which was raised to all U.S. vipers. The half-life tends to be shorter than that of snake venom, so rarely, as I showed, there can be some late effects. Anti-VIP was only developed for rattlesnakes, although there's increasing data. It does work for water moccasins and copperheads. The other thing about anti-venom is it's outrageously expensive, and a typical venomation will probably have a $100,000 bill or so. So, as I warned, I will take some liberties with this talk. I am fascinated by Gila monsters, so even though the only Gila monsters is in the High Desert Museum in Bend, Oregon, I do like Gila monsters, so we're going to talk about Gila monsters. These are fascinating animals. They're up to 2 feet long. They're the state reptile of Utah, which is interesting because it only occurs in one county in Utah, but again, other people like Gila monsters. And interestingly, they only eat 5 to 10 times a year. To me, they're pretty animals. They're also, variants of this are called the beaded lizards, but they're very brightly colored, and again, can be pretty huge animals. They're the only venomous lizard. They drip small amounts of venom into saliva. Fatal bites in the past were really only reported in children or in people who literally got bit and just left the animal on them or passed out. The bites are incredibly painful. That's their major hazard. There are rare reports of anaphylaxis, and recently an unfortunate gentleman died after his pet Gila monster bit him. And it's pretty, to at least me, pretty clear by reading the reports, it probably was anaphylaxis. He'd been multiply bit. What's fascinating is the venom of the Gila monster helped develop the GLP-1 agonist that we use now, like Ozempic. So it turns out Gila monsters may actually be credited with helping us with the obesity epidemic. So again, I think they're great animals. First aid, the lizard bites and tends not to get let go. You can bang it on the ground. Some people just say, just put your hand on the ground, the lizard will run away. You can pry it off. If the Gila monster escapes from Bend and bites people, you look at the wound for broken teeth, pain control. Very rarely, and usually in children, there's hypotension, you need IV fluids. The other reason why I like talking about Gila monsters is that of all the things I've read in the wilderness medicine literature, the worst advice I ever read was how to get a Gila monster off of you. So what this article recommended years ago was to put chloroform or gasoline into the Gila monster's mouth and then apply the flame from a match or cigarette lighter. And I'm like going, what's a Gila monster flamethrower going to do? It's just to like burn off your fingers. Anyway, please don't do this. So Gila monsters, I think maybe we should be more grateful for them. So anyway, so this ironically was an infectious disease doctor who showed me her ankle one day and when I was walking to work, and this turned out to be a bite from a vampire bat. Now, there's no vampire bats in Oregon. We don't have to worry about that, but bats, we do have a lot of bats in Oregon, and they have very sharp little bat teeth that can bite you. And my friend was bitten and actually did not realize it. It was while she was asleep and was pointed out by somebody the next day. And the bruising is actually not from the bite, but from the rabies. And so rabies vaccine, rabies is a terrible way to die. If you remember nothing else from this talk, don't get rabies. Rabies are always concerned with any mammal bites. Bats are always a concern. Bats don't get sick with rabies. The bite goes unnoticed. And what's particularly disgusting is if the bat licks an open wound or crawls on you because the bat licks its paws, you can get rabies from that. And the variant of rabies passed by bats actually tends to grow a little bit better in skin. So bats are pretty nasty. And in fact, if you look at the deaths from rabies since 1960, the majority of the deaths now from rabies are from bats. There's occasional foreign dogs, raccoons, local dogs are pretty rare. the biggest issue is bats. And again, this is distribution of rabid bats in the United States, and they're basically everywhere. So any bat in the United States must be considered rabid, because bats don't get sick and die with rabies, just like they don't get sick with COVID or Ebola or anything else. And what's unfortunate is people tend not to realize this. This is a particularly sad case of a child bitten by a bat. And the parents said, well, it's a bat bite, you know, we're not going to do anything about it. What's the harm of a bat bite? And the kid sadly died of rabies. So there's education needs. The other thing I'd point out is, I would admit the bias, I tend to be more of a dog person. So I'd like to point out that in the United States, consistently, there are more rabid cats than dogs. Although dogs are the biggest threat worldwide. You know, cats spread pestilence and plague too. Maybe I should have a talk on cats, the hazard among us. But anyway, foxes, mongooses, raccoons, and again, dogs, as I just said, worldwide are a big threat, but not in the United States. And the reason why is, oh, I'd like again to point out more rabid cats than dogs. So the reason why is that after World War II, there was a big public health effort to vaccinate dogs for rabies. So yes, there used to be rabid dogs in the United States, and 50 people a year would die of rabies. With public health measures, vaccination, rabies in dogs have almost been pretty much eliminated. And again, no more cats than dog gets rabies. And so this has been a big public health measure. Right now, bats are the biggest issue. So if you look across the United States, raccoons are a big issue on the East Coast. Skunks are a big issue in the Central Plains. Foxes and skunks in Arizona. But everywhere, bats are a major concern. If you look at the Great Northwest, in Oregon, there's been 258 rabid bats reported in 20 years, two cats, no dogs, 27 foxes, three coyotes, one skunk, and one goat. Washington, it's the same thing, 500 bats, there must be more bats in Washington, two cats, no dogs, and one llama. I don't want to be near a rabid llama, but anyway. And obviously llama horses get it from being bit by rabid skunks or foxes or bats. But again, bats are the biggest issue. So what do you do if you get bit by a bat, as I had recent experience with? You do vigorous wound cleaning. And actually there's data that good wound cleaning actually prevents your chance of getting infected by 50%. You get rabies immune globulin into the wound and then vaccinated. If I were to ever get bit again, I don't need immune globulin, but I do need updates to my vaccination. So again, this is a study in unfortunate guinea pigs that showed cleaning, even with tap water, soap worked much better. This must have been sponsored by Ivory Soap since it's specifically mentioned, but washing the wound is good, especially if you're in an austere area or in another country. Washing the wound is the first step. Allegedly, the American embassies are supposed to carry immune globulin. I don't know if that's still true. You do have a few days to get definitive therapy. So here is my unfortunate head with bat bites. And yes, I was running. And the immune globulin, the vaccine is purple, so you know it's strong. So anyway, so what about big animal bites? And before we turn to charismatic megafauna, the animal bites have multiple mechanisms of injury. The biggest thing is biting. Biting can avulse tissue, can lacerate tissue, and especially with big cats, you can have very deep puncture wounds. You can be clawed, you can be swiped with the paw, and you know, many animals, you know, a buffalo weighs a ton, and there can be just simply brute force injury. Most injuries are to the hands, you know, the arms and hands, because you're fighting off the animal. Sadly, many animals actually aim for the face, so it can be devastating facial injury. And big cats tend to go for the neck. So treatment generally of animal wounds is major bleeding needs to be treated first, airway, breathing, and then circulation. You need to screen for blunt trauma. The wound needs to be cleared and irrigated, teeth taken out, devitalized tissue needs to be done. And again, ideally, this should be done right after the bite, like if you're out hiking or something. Closure is really very controversial because of the high rates of infection. People will try to close fresh wounds, especially facial wounds for cosmesis. Infection risk factors is a big issue. All cats are considered a risk of infection. Human bites, primates, pigs, a lot of other animals automatically are infection risk factors. Thin tissue, any joint penetration is a risk factor for infection. Antibiotics, amoxicillin, CLAV is the workhorse of wilderness medicine besides toxicycline. If not, Clinda, fluoroquinolones can vary by animal. And again, don't forget tetanus. Wound pathogens, all wild antibiotics are considered contaminated. High-risk cases, you need antibiotics. And again, any big carnivore or any animal that's acting crazy, believe it or not, there's an outbreak of rabid beavers on the East Coast that literally will swim up and attack swimmers. Those need to be vaccinated. It's species dependent. Cats, their sharp little cat teeth will fill you full of Pastorella. Bears are Eremonis mycobacterium. You're bit by a swan, that's Pseudomonas. And for Tasmanian devils, it's also Pastorella. And I kind of recommend this article because it's very interesting for how many different bacteria animals carry. So coyotes are really big in the Northwest. And what's fascinating is this is new. This is only since the 80s. The range of coyotes have actually gradually expanded over time with reduction of predators. And what's very interesting now is it's becoming apparent that many coyotes are adapting to urban life. Their ecology's changing. It's like, hey, there's food all around. This is great. And are becoming a very adept to urban life. Coyotes were actually only seen in Portland in about first time in 1980. There's probably now at least 1,500, and I bet 2,000 coyotes. Their average territory is huge, like 4.5 square miles. 1 to 2% of its diet is cats. And it always makes me sad. There's a lot of coyotes near OHSU, and you're always walking and see these signs. If you've seen Fluffy, please call. And I'm like, I know what happened to Fluffy. And the attacks are similar to dog attacks. They tend to be very vigorous biters. There's actually a website to report coyotes, and this is the distribution in the Portland Urban Coyote Project. So again, these are pretty ubiquitous, and I've seen them running on Shoals Ferry. I see them a lot when I go running in the morning in my neighborhood. This is Portland's most famous coyote, the one that got on the streetcar at the airport and went for a ride. And they thoughtfully took it to a field and let it loose. I also like it because it's the genesis of one of my favorite Slater Kinney songs, Light Rail Coyote, which I recommend listening to for extra credit after the talk. So what is the deal with coyotes? They're not your pets. Don't feed them. Try not to let your pets run loose. If you see a coyote, a good rule of thumb for almost all animals is never run from it. Repellents, fencing may help. You know, don't charge it, try to shoo it away. And you know, if a coyote is aggressive, it's fearless, it's either rabid or it's really ill-behaved and needs to be dealt with, and you should report that. But if you want to learn more, this was actually a fascinating website, the Portland Coyote Project. You can report coyotes, you can learn more about it. Again, there's a lot of fascinating research going on into how coyote ecology is changing. But what about bears? That's what everybody thinks about when they think about aggressive animals. And bear attacks are responsible for most wild animal deaths. And there's increasing bear-human interaction. Now, probably we're habituated with black bears. I mean, that doesn't mean you should own one as a pet, but you know, we coexist with black bears. There's thousands of black bears in Oregon, you know, and I go to the Oregon coast, you go in the morning, you see black bear prints all over. And we're probably a bit habituated. Grizzly, probably not as much. So coloration isn't a big help. You know, black bears can be brown, grizzly bears can be black or any color, even white. But in general, grizzlies are bigger. Their ears tend to be shorter. What I found most useful in the field is grizzlies usually have a hump on their back, and you don't want to get that close, but grizzlies tend to have bigger claws. So again, here's a grizzly bear that's mainly on the white side. Grizzlies still have a restricted range. There are some in the North Cascades. The last grizzly was seen in Oregon about 1934. And again, mainly in the national parks and especially in Canada and Alaska. Black bears are much more common. We have a lot in Oregon and Washington. There's a lot in the United States. And again, they seem to figure it out more or less how to coexist with humans. So black bears in general are widespread. They can weigh up to 650 pounds. They have smaller claws, about 1 to 2 inches. The mothers tend not to be as aggressive with their cubs. Again, it doesn't mean I'd go up and pet one, but you know, a mom and a cub, if you're not really that aggressive, will not attack you. Oregon, it's estimated about 25 to 30,000 black bears. Washington, about 25,000 black bears. They're very common. Grizzlies, again, have much more restricted range. They can be huge, up to 850 pounds. Very large claws, the better to slash you with. The mothers are very protective. What I mean by that is if there is a mom with her cubs and you're just walking by, she will perceive that as a threat and attack you. A black bear mom probably will not. Washington has a few, Oregon none. But again, if you look at deaths, they're mainly grizzlies. And again, mainly in the national parks. And again, some scattered black bear deaths in the United States. Bears often attack and aim for the face. They have multiple ways they can harm you. Their teeth can bite and chew you. Their claws can slice you. They can pin you down. Going up a tree won't help because the bear can just pull you down out of the tree. Remember, those claws, they're very good to climb with. So most bear attacks are still provoked. A lot of it's a perceived threat. Again, a grizzly's with her mom, with a grizzly mom's with her cubs, and you walk by, you turn around a corner, and there's a grizzly eating a wolf, and you're just getting too close. There are rare unprovoked attacks. Most of these tend to be grizzlies, but every now and then a black bear will decide to become predatory. Sadly, one that's usually been fed by humans and become predatory. The key to avoidance is to make a lot of noise. Bear bells don't work. There's some evidence that actually bears now associate bear bells with food, kind of the last association you want. Traveling in groups, it's very unusual for groups of three or more to have been attacked. You know, when you're camping, don't leave food on the trail, especially in grizzly areas, you know, a lot of food protection. But common sense prevention is the key. And again, I like these kind of humorous things from the National Park Service. But again, bears have very good vision. They could smell. Stay a football field away. Sadly, there's one victim found. They looked at his photos, and it's just him getting closer and closer to the bear until the last one's the bear charging him. So don't do that. I don't recommend this friendly advice either. Friends don't use friends as bear bait. What if you are attacked by a grizzly? Don't run away from it. Walk away slowly. Try to be non-threatening. You have bear spray, which your grizzly country should have. You spray it at 25 yards. Distraction's good. Take your backpack and throw it somewhere else. Maybe the grizzly will look at that. Throw your phone, don't throw it at him, but throw them somewhere else. If you're charged, a lot of times these are bluff charges and you play dead. You protect your face and belly in the dirt, and you put your hands over your neck and play dead. This, most of the time, will be enough. A lot of the charges are bluff charges. A lot of the time, the bear will just kind of inspect you, but lay down for about 30 minutes, because sometimes they come back. Black bears, you can scare away. They don't like to be, they don't like confrontation. So look big, yelling, again, bear spray at 25 yards. If a black bear charges you, it wants to eat you, so fight back and punch the eyes, punch the nose. Those are the most vulnerable areas. Bear spray is very effective. In studies in Alaska, it's 90% effective at preventing an attack, 98% an injury rate in close encounters. Firearms are much lower. Go with bear spray. You can rent it from REI when you're in Alaska or any grizzly prone area going into, I would recommend it. Firearms don't work because, see this little triangle is, that's where you have to plug the bear to stop it in its tracks. So it's charging you, you're not used, it's just much better to spray a thing, a bear spray at it. Also, please note the ginormous claws. Cougars are making a comeback. The news is full. A few years ago, there's a hiker killed by a cougar. There a biker recently killed by cougars. They're making a big comeback. There's a lot of cougars. Oregon has about 6,000 cougars. Washington, about 3,600. They breed and live. And again, their range is expanding. I know this because I gave it just a virtual talk to Wisconsin last week, but like there's up to 30 to 40 sightings now in Wisconsin, and there may be breeding pairs there. So they're making a comeback. There's been 50 attacks since 1970. At least 5 adults and 5 killed children have been killed. Most of these are either in California, Vancouver Island, or Colorado. Really, again, areas where we're encroaching on cougar territory. We're familiar with the Cannon Beach cougar. Here they are around Haystack Rock, you know, kind of enjoying a nice little dip in the ocean. So young cougars are more likely to attack. Children are more likely to attack. It's probably because cougars need to expand and get their territory out when they're young. And finding new territories, they're more forced to human inhabited areas. And sadly, surprise attacks are more common, where the cougar just leaps on you. Now, these are still very rare. There's a lot of people now, you know, have these cameras that take pictures of wildlife. There's cougars wandering on people's porches, wandering down the street. Again, most cougars don't want to mess with you. The scariest thing I ever read was this. The most intrusive case involved a cougar crashing through the window of an isolated cabin to attack a telephone lineman. So if you just want to worry about something. Cougars tend to aim at your head and back. It bites through the great vessels in the airway. It can force the neck and hyperextension. That's how the cougar kills its prey. Puncture wounds are very deep, need to be irrigated and inspected, and they're often much deeper than suspected. These are cougar teeth. This is its mouth. Look where the muscle is to run its jaw. These are very powerful bites. They're very devastating, very deep. They can fracture bones. What happens if you do see a cougar? Again, if it attacks you, fight back. Try to poke outside. Try to do this. Hands around its neck to go and snap its neck. Make noise. Hey, bear spray will probably work. Don't stoop down. You know, hey, that target's now better. For some reason, don't stare at it. It's like stare, you know, it's a cat. So don't stare. You never stare at a cat. It'll bite you. So you don't make eye attack. And certainly don't try to run away from a cougar. You're not going to outrun a cougar. Treatment, the key is there can be spine injuries, and the injuries to the neck can be very deep. Moose. There are a few moose in Oregon, but again, especially in the northern United States, Canada, Maine, there are a lot of moose. Again, Alaska by far is the biggest for moose, but we do have some in Oregon. These are large animals. They can weigh up to 1,500 pounds. Again, they almost always avoid people. You know, I'm in Alaska, the moose kind of looks at you and shuffles along its way. Where are they going to attack? Again, the mother with its young. I remember hiking on our honeymoon in the Tetons and turning a corner and there's a mother and her young and we just slowly crept away. Dogs are another issue. You go running with your dog, the dog goes and chases the moose. Moose chases the dog and comes back and starts to stomp you. And mooses actually stomp its victims to death. Here's a moose with its young by slowly backing away me. Warning signs, if the ear turns rearward, the rump hair goes up. And kind of an obvious sign, if the moose starts licking its lips, or the mom's with the calves, you need to flee. Easiest thing is just to hide behind a tree. Again, most mooses don't want confrontation, like, oh, it went away. You can run away from a moose. Now, you can't outrun a moose, but mooses get very bored. And again, it's just, oh, that jerk is running away, fine. And if you are stumped by a moose, again, curl up like a ball, protect your neck, and hope it goes away. So here's an angry moose. Buffalo. There are a few buffalo in Oregon. There's about a few hundred. So the numbers are increasing in Northwest. There's buffalo farms, but wild buffalo herds are being reintroduced. Buffalo are huge. They can weigh a ton. And despite weighing a ton, they can run up to 20 miles an hour. The vast majority, almost every report of a buffalo injury I ever read is you're just too close. The average injury distance for buffalo injury is 10 feet, which means you got way too close to the buffalo. The mechanisms are often goring. Remember, buffalo have these large, very tough horns on them. And so they gore with those. The gore wounds can be 8 to 10 inches deep. They're usually the lower legs, the buttocks, because the victim is running away and they get gored. The perineum can be involved. These can be the devastating injuries. In the very rare injuries when people are attacked by the front, they're usually fatal because being gored in your abdomen and your chest isn't that good. The second mechanism of injury is when the buffalo gores you, it then tosses you into the air, an average of 8 to 10 feet. So there's also a lot of blunt injury from being tossed in the air. So again, they're cute, but please avoid them. So again, wounds need a lot of exploration. They can be deep, devastating wounds. Who knows where that horn has been? So antibiotic prophylaxis is needed. And prevention's key. They're cute, but please stay 25 yards away and don't get near them. So the epitome of the Northwest animal is obviously Bigfoot. And this is a creature mainly found in the Northwest. If we look here, Washington and Oregon lead in reported sightings. I have no idea what's going on in West Virginia. Maybe they go out there to mine. I don't know. But there seems to be a lot of Bigfoot sightings in West Virginia. But the Northwest is the key. There's been long stories of a hairy beast in Northwest woods. As far as I can find in the literature, there's no reported Bigfoot attacks. Although, interestingly, several people have been shot mistaken for Bigfoot, so don't wear your fur coat during hunting season. But what would happen? I mean, we got to be prepared for anything if you were attacked by Bigfoot. Well, it's probably going to be a lot of blunt trauma because Bigfoot is big. There's no microbiology available in Bigfoot's mouth, and I probably would treat it as some sort of human bite. And so human bites, as we know, can be deliberate or accidental. And fight bites are a particular concern, you know, people punching each other, because that involves tendons, ligaments, bones, and joints. There's actually an incredible infection risk with human bites. You're better off being bitten by a dog, unless it's rabid. Staph, strep, alplanella. Often their wounds are infected because people are like, oh, I got drunk and punched somebody. And they're not going to go to the ER until their hand's infected. So a lot of times the infection's already established. There's obviously risk of HIV and hepatitis. Again, our friends amoxiclav is good for prophylaxis or combination therapy if you're allergic to penicillin. Now, fight bites and any bite to the hand needs to have a hand surgeon involved. The tendon function's disrupted. They need to go to the operating room to be explored and irrigated, need IV antibiotics. Again, hand bites to humans are also pretty, human hand bites are also pretty bad because there's a lot of closed and potential spaces there. But again, this is the problem with the fight bite, is the tooth can really lash the ligament, go in the joint space, go in the bone, go into some of the fascial planes. They're late reported, can be devastated. So finally, what is the deadliest animal in the Northwest? The rough-skinned newt. Now, I can sense a disappointment among everybody on that one, but this is pound for pound by far the deadliest animal. Just look at its face, look at it. So there's a couple case reports. A 29-year-old man drank approximately 150 mils of whiskey. I love the scientific notation, you know. At 6 p.m., he swallowed a newt on a dare. Within 10 minutes, he complained of tingling. I think this ended up being fatal. A 26-year-old man ingested 5 newts on a bet. He'd been drinking at the time. So again, we learned young man and alcohol and newts don't mix well. But newts actually contain teratotoxin. The average Oregon newt contains 250 micrograms of teratotoxin. The fatal dose is 1 microgram. So 1 newt in theory could kill 250 people. This is much more toxic than cyanide. It's produced by bacteria in the skin. It's actually a neurotoxin. It blocks the sodium gates in the nerves and it leads to fatal paralysis. So this is what puffer fishes have. And so the red and orange are where most of the teratotoxin is in a puffer fish. So that's why you gotta pay some guy a lot of money to clean it good. This is the newt. Look at how much red and orange there. The newt is full of teratotoxin. So don't be eating newts. And there's what teratotoxin does. So this is the range of the rough-skinned newt. It is found in all wet areas in the Northwest, Vancouver Island, and even going up to a little bit of Alaska. So teratotoxin, again, from newts, from puffer fishes, it poisons muscles. You get paralysis of all your muscle groups. You get hypothermia, hypotension. It's very rapid and there's no treatment. Basically, it's supportive care, ventilation until the toxin wears off. Now, why newts? It actually turns out to be a fascinating story. Garter snakes eat newts. Curiously, garter snakes have teratotoxin, so don't eat garter snakes either. But there's in this evolution where garter snakes get teratotoxin to sort of build up its immunity. And it turns out garter snakes keep evolving sodium channels that are resistant to teratotoxin. So newts have evolved to have much more teratotoxin. It seems to be a very interesting coevolution of predator and prey. So what's the conclusion? There's an incredible amount of animal hazards in the Northwest. But again, most of these are pretty rare and can be avoided by prudent caution, you know, making noise, don't provoking animals. So I think the bottom line of my talk is don't be stupid with the animals. Don't be stupid with the animals. And again, this is why the average buffalo attack is 10 feet. Well, I will stop there. Again, I thank you very much for putting up with me ranting and raving about bats and newts, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. Yes.
Great.
That was great. Thanks. A lot more people are exposed to bats or have bat encounters, but don't actually get bitten by them. But then there's a lot of hysteria that comes in the wake of that exposure. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, someone finds a bat in their house, they get it out. Nobody was obviously bitten, but people are in a panic.
Yeah, I think there are some pretty reasonable rules that have been set up. So if the bat's in the house, it's clear, didn't touch anybody, you shoot it out, that's okay. I think where people will be concerned, like you wake up and there's a bat in your bedroom, it might have bitten you. Again, you don't know. Or if there's a child or impaired person there, those have a concern. But again, the bat's around and you shoot it out, that's okay.
I'm going to press you on that one just a little bit, because these are the folks who call our primary care clinic, right? Wake up with a bat in the room. Can you get any more specific on whether to worry or not?
So the recommendations that I've read, again, the Oregon Public Health has a nice website about this, but if you wake up and there's a bat in your bedroom, you can't be sure it didn't bite or lick you. So better part of valor is getting that. And I remember a horror story, a friend of mine who goes whitewater kayaking was on a trip, heard this scream from a tent, and one of her tent mate woke up with a bat kissing her. So, and again, that's enough to transmit it. So again, rabies is nasty. Although I agree, prophylaxis is crazy and expensive.
Great.
But I like to think it gives me magic powers I can take on a raccoon now.
Thanks so much for the help on that one. I'll be watching for questions here in the room, so let me know. Feel free to go ahead and raise your hand. question going back to the start of the talk when we were talking about bees and wasps and anaphylaxis and EpiPens. Any practical comments on expirations with EpiPens and whether they need to be kept in particular conditions, too hot, too cold?
Yeah. Things? So conditions are pretty much room temperature conditions. I think people would get concerned if somebody left their EpiPen out on a hot day in the car, it may degrade the epinephrine. There's some evidence for that. In theory, they're good at least for a year after an expiration date. People often feel queasy about recommending that just because it's anaphylaxis and stuff, but most are good after. And actually what I do is my wife's horribly allergic to kiwi and I always carry her expired EpiPen. So I'm not allergic to anything, but I just feel it's good to have an EpiPen. You know, if you talk the talk, you got to have one. So they're probably good at least for a year after the expiration date. The other trick that you can find on YouTube is if you have the time to do it, is there actually multiple doses. By law, EpiPens have to deliver at least two doses to guarantee to get one. And you can actually cut them apart, great YouTube videos on this, and actually administer up to four more doses from an EpiPen. And finally, the last tip is the purists who like go on expeditions and stuff, instead of carrying EpiPens, will take the trouble of actually having a vial of epinephrine and needles and stuff to draw it up. But that's probably only for elaborate expeditions.
That's a real question. I'd love to know how you got bitten by bats while running.
That's a good question. Literally, it was actually during the smoky thing of 2020, the fitting in of the apocalyptic year. And literally, I was a block from my house, felt something grabbing my head, what's left of my hair, and scratching me. I grabbed it, it was a bat. I screamed and let it go. Probably instant sterilization was done by the obscenities that came out of my mouth. But what was interesting is when I went into the primary care, they said, oh, you know, you're the fourth person this week that's been bitten by a bat. If you actually look at the rabid bat reports, there's a peak in September of 2020. So I think some people theorize the smoke or something was throwing them off. Although the infectious disease doctor I consulted, the idea was that I probably looked like a disabled insect when I ran. And we just looked like a delectable target. Yeah, unfortunately, I have no glamorous story. I was literally a block from my house.
How would you actually get rid of a bat that flies in through the window and is up on the ceiling?
It is difficult. What we used to do in the Midwest was just take a broom and try to shoo it away. We were lucky in my town, we actually had a mammalogist who would come to people's house and remove bats. But sometimes I know the Audubon Society and then I can't remember what public health service, like the people that also pick up the dead animals in the road can help. But sometimes just trying to shoo them out with a broom or some large thing can help. It'll avoid you. So the nice thing about bats is they usually will avoid you.
One other thing, how much is an EpiPen these days?
Oh, they're still expensive. I believe the last one I prescribed was about $200. And so I think people try to make them generic. And like I said, I think a lot of people go on expeditions and stuff. That's why they buy the vials, which are a lot cheaper.
You know, the vials are so multiple. Every spinal anesthetic kit has epinephrine and ephedrine. We used to throw away hundreds of those vials. Mm-hmm. I mean, why don't the hospitals make them available?
Oh, that's actually a great idea.
Quality improvement project, anybody? Great. And we're focusing mostly on the Pacific Northwest, but it was really interesting to look at the global impact of snake bites. Do you happen to know current progress on global research in anti-venom or approaches to? Yeah.
So I think there've been two things. One, there has been use of anti-venoms and it's more delivery. So people are literally like looking at drones and other things. So that still is kind of high-techy. I think the big effort now that people work on is actually vaccination. Is actually, can you vaccinate people to anti-venom, to the venom and try to prevent it? So I think, if I had to guess, I think that's going to be the big impact. And there is a lot of interest in that because I think You know, we still have deaths in the United States from this with a fairly good healthcare system. Snakes are, you know, the elapids paralyzed within 15 minutes. And so, you know, I think even if we had elapids here, I mean, if we had cobras here, we'd have a lot more deaths. So I think actually vaccinations and trying to see if people can raise a strong enough response to neutralize the snake venom is going to be the way to go.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Wilderness Medicine Society locally?
Yes. So the main ones nationally. So the Wilderness Medical Society was founded many years ago. And I think the thing I like about it is that's two meetings a year. The next meeting's at Snowbird in late July. And it's mainly a collection of, it's not just emergency room docs. I mean, I'm a hematologist. When I was on the board, there's a hematologist, an orthopedic surgeon, and an ophthalmologist. So it's a wide variety of doctors, but it's mainly hearing lectures on wilderness medicine. There is training. There's a fellowship involved you could do. And so it's WMS.org. And I think it's a great organization. The thing I belong to in the Northwest, which is very nice, is actually a coalition of medical schools. So OHSU, UW, Western University, I'm spacing on a couple others. The students have gotten together, formed a wilderness medicine organization. They actually do all the running on it. They put on a conference a year. There's some of us on the board, allegedly keep them out of trouble, but actually they end up teaching us things. And that's been a fun organization. So they like did a conference at the Kiwanis camp on Mount Hood this January. They had like 160 people there, many great speakers, simulations and stuff. So I think in the medical schools, there's also a lot of local interest. But I think globally, the Wilderness Medical Society, I think they have both the regular meetings and like fun CME things. Like I think they're having a desert conference next year. They do a lot of sailing medicine and stuff. So I think it's worth checking out.
Great. Thanks so much. Of interest to many, I'm sure. I have one last late arriving question here. How dangerous is it to pick up a newt?
Probably not that dangerous. I would wash my hands afterwards. There's probably a little bit, but it doesn't really break through the skin that much. You know, maybe if you picked up a newt, then picked up a sandwich, you might get a little... Maybe get that buzz that people like from the pufferfish, but I wouldn't recommend it. But probably picking it up is okay, but would wash the hands. And keep your kid from putting it in its mouth. Yes.
In the last 20 seconds, Doctor, open water swimmers, especially on the East Coast, get neurotoxin, I think, from algae or something in these blooms. So those of us that do open water swimming here, they sometimes cancel the swim. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've run into this in your wilderness medicine.
Yes, so that's a fascinating thing. I actually have a whole talk on water hazards, but you can't beat a talk that has a brain eating amoeba in it. But the algae blooms are difficult. There's some here. I know in Alaska they have trouble blooms, and then they get into the mollusk and you get this thing where you can't remember anything anymore. But that is a big issue, and probably with the oceans warming, the incidence of that is going up a bit. But those are difficult. There's really nothing to do about them because it's just natural part of the plankton that has these toxins in it. The other interesting water-related thing that we had a big outbreak in the East Coast, in Illinois once, so I remembered, is that sometimes triathletes and stuff, when it rains a lot, it washes animal pee into the lakes and ocean and rivers, which spread leptospirosis. There's actually been a couple of huge leptospirosis outbreaks in triathlons from people drinking the water and the leptospirosis.
Yes. I do believe we perhaps had an Oregon ACP poster on leptospirosis in the triathlete. Mike Placid.
Not for them, but for...
Great. Here we are at 9 o'clock. Thank you so much, Dr. DeLowery.
Thank you.